And hello, everybody. Welcome to Beyond the Matrix, the radio program that asks you to get outside the box of conventional thought and fly and soar with the eagles in the free thought zone. And that is what we're going to do tonight. This is Patricia Corey. I want to start by apologizing to you all for being gone so long. I have been all over the place as usual with my Sacred Journeys tours. We've been in the Maya lands, and so I have not been able to come through with my show, but I'm back, and I'm back with a vengeance with Dr. Rick Strassman, who is, there's so much to tell you about my guest, I don't know where to start. He is a director, a doctor of psychiatry, and he's also the noted author of a number of books. I'm interested in the two particular ones we'll be talking about today, DMT, the spirit molecule you know about for sure, and we'll let you know a little bit more about his new or latest book in a minute. So before I bring him in, I just wanted to thank you all for your patience. I know that it's been, 4 weeks since I've been with you, but as I said, I'm back, and we're going to be doing some really exciting programs with you on Beyond the Matrix. So without any further ado, let me introduce him again. Dr. Rick Strassman, I've asked him for permission to call him Rick. Are you with me, Rick?
I am. Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you for being here. I've just wanted to start by telling you that I have been following your work for a while now, and I asked you to be on the show because I think you're really at the cutting edge of some pretty exciting stuff. So I'm going to just quickly talk about, your bio. Your background is so vast. What can we say? Tell us a little bit about your background so that I don't have to try to summarize these years and years and years of incredible training and your journey into medicine.
Well, let's see. Just in terms of my professional background, I went to college at Pomona College and Stanford University, both my first 2 years at Pomona and my second 2 years at Stanford. And then I attended medical school at the Albert Einstein College of Medicine of Yeshiva University in New York City for the years 1969 to 1973 till 1977. And then I trained in general psychiatry at UC Davis in California in Sacramento until 1981. And then took some extra training at UC San Diego in psychopharmacology research. And then moved out to the University of New Mexico in the early 1980s and took another couple of years of post-fellowship training.
And you're currently clinical associate professor of psychiatry at the University of New Mexico School of Medicine.
Right, right.
That's an impressive background, and it has taken you no doubt in some pretty interesting areas. I'm going to be talking with you tonight about your research with psychedelic drugs in over 20 years and your discoveries about basically, chemical reactions in the human brain and the effects of melatonin in the brain. I don't know where to start. Let's start with this is Beyond the Matrix. We want to just cut loose here, so please feel free to take us to the edge of reality as far as your work is concerned and your discoveries.
Well, I guess you'd want to hear about the first book. That's called DMT, the Spirit Molecule. That came out in 2001. As you were mentioning, that describes the first new American psychedelic drug research in humans in about 20, 25 years or so. It's kind of interesting, actually. It's been a number of years since I stopped the research. That was 1995 when I kind of hung things up. And I ran the studies. It's pushing almost 20 years now. It seems like it just couldn't possibly be that long ago. But we started them in 1990, and I wrapped them up in 1995. I was interested in studying this particular drug, DMT, which stands for dimethyltryptamine. It's a chemical cousin of both serotonin and of melatonin. It's a naturally occurring hallucinogen that all of our bodies make at all times. It's primarily made in the lungs, and it's found in quite a few different hundreds of plants. All of the mammals that has been studied in, so far has been discovered in rabbits and guinea pigs and mice and those kinds of animals. It's a very short-acting drug, so I figured that any new studies with these compounds, it would be an important thing to make certain that it was a briefly acting drug, because the studies had to occur in a hospital on a research unit, and I was afraid if there were any adverse reactions, if the drug were over quickly, that would be beneficial.
Okay, let me interject a question here. So what exactly is DMT? I mean, you've said what it is as far as the chemical name of it, but let me reframe my question. Why is this drug occurring in so many living beings? What is the purpose of this chemical?
Well, that's a good question, and that's one of the questions I was hoping to start to answer by virtue of doing the studies that I was. I began in the field with an interest in the biological basis of mystical experiences, and it seemed to me if there were some sort of compound in the brain that were psychedelic, that might be involved in non-drug-induced mystical states or near-death experiences or spiritual kinds of alterations in consciousness. So my study intended to give people a number of different doses of DMT and determine if there were indeed any similarities between the effects of giving the drug and spontaneous spiritual experiences, for example, ones that might come about through prayer, through meditation, or through fasting, or through exhaustive exercise, any kind of naturally occurring stimulus for a spiritual experience. In terms of its existence in all of these plants and other animals, I mean, that's a good question. As time has gone on and I've thought about some of the results of my study, I like to maybe think about the presence of DMT in plants and other species as almost a Esperanto, like a trans-species or interspecies Esperanto, where it's the matrix or it's the medium through which communication can take place between disparate sorts of species.
Well, that's a fascinating idea. So then you would suggest that it would be some sort of a vehicle of higher communication, higher consciousness between all living beings?
Well, it could be the medium through which, shared experiences can take place in, those species that contain it. Obviously, if the animal or the species or the plant or whatever life, form we're talking about, if it didn't have DMT, then there wouldn't be that channel of communication. This is obviously speculation, but still, you are interested in speculation, so there are plenty of interesting ideas that we can...
Well, yeah, let's say that science takes us to a certain point, and then the human spirit and mind contemplate what those facts can mean, and that's, I guess, speculation.
Yeah, well, it's the power of the imagination, to combine, data in new and interesting sorts of ways. And, once you can imagine a particular thing, then you can go about experimentally studying it and determining if it's objectively, verifiable.
But you do call it the spirit molecule as a title of your book.
Yeah, well, as I started off with, as far as an introduction to, some of these ideas, I was interested in there being some kind of molecular underpinning of spiritual experiences in people and the presence of DMT seemed like a great candidate, for that kind of a substance.
Well, what's very exciting here is the idea that, okay, great, this chemical is produced within the human mind or the human body, but to think that this is also present in other living species as some kind of a connecting spiritual fluid between various species is very exciting. And this
so there's a new thing coming through the West. It's called ayahuasca. It's a plant brew. It's a combination of two different plants, and it and it originates in the Amazon basin. It contains a plant, well, of the two plants that ayahuasca contains, one of them possesses DMT, and the other possesses a chemical which allows the DMT to be orally active. Otherwise, the DMT is broken down in the gut as quickly as you swallow it. It's been used by shamans in the jungle for quite a long time, perhaps thousands of years even. It's also, though, made inroads into Brazilian ayahuasca using churches, which seem to be springing up all over the place, both obviously in Brazil, but also in Western Europe and in the U.S. and Canada. One of the striking aspects of the subjective experience of ayahuasca is the real powerful and very strong, experience, the strong feeling of actually being in communication with a plant spirit. It isn't an animal spirit. It isn't like a purely spiritual entity. It's a plant intelligence that, seems to exist in the brew. And, perhaps that is, an example of the cross species or even cross kingdom, communication that may take place in species that contain DMT.
Yeah, well, I've had quite a few people on that have talked about the ayahuasca experience, and it does fascinate me that not so much the experience for itself, but the fact that so many people now are, let's say, awakening to the ayahuasca journey time of shifting. It's interesting that it's becoming so, let's say, widely used for spiritual, not for entertainment, drugs, but for a spiritual pursuit.
Yeah, and, the visionary ingredient in ayahuasca is DMT. I think there is particular, relevance to learning as much about DMT as we possibly can within the context of the increasing popularity of ayahuasca out there.
The only thing I don't understand is you say that it's a very, very fast-acting chemical, and yet the ayahuasca journey is quite long, isn't it?
Yeah, it's around 6 hours or so, but that's because of the combination of the two plants. One contains the ayahuasca, which is swallowed, in the studies I was doing, I was giving the pure DMT intravenously.
Whoa.
If you swallowed just pure DMT by itself, it's broken down in the stomach immediately. And on the street, it's not a very commonly used street bug, a street drug, but if it is used on the street, it's smoked, in order, to bypass the stomach. But these Indians, stumbled upon or discovered somehow or another that if you combine another plant with the one that contains the DMT, then you can, swallow the DMT containing plant and, it comes on in about a half hour, an hour, and it lasts for three or, four more hours. You come down within the next hour or two after that. So it's a lot more leisurely pace of the unfolding of the effects.
So when you were giving intravenous DMT shots, was this, first of all, illegal?
No. Actually, it took me 2 years to get all of the required paperwork in order with the U.S. government. As I was mentioning, it was the first, such study in the States in quite a long time. And, the reason it had taken so long for any new studies to start after 1970 or so is because of the incredible paperwork that was involved in doing any such studies, like these in humans. And so it actually took me 2 years of permit applications, interacting with the Food and Drug Administration, with the DEA, with a number of different local and state and federal agencies, before I was actually able to get the study off the ground legally. Yeah, I got funds from the Scottish Rite Foundation, which is a branch of the Masons, actually. And also some funds from the National Institutes of Health in the U.S. Yeah, so, the studies were above board completely.
So what kind of reactions did people have when they were getting this super hit of DMT? It's hard for me to imagine getting this immediate, let's say if it's intravenous, this would be just like boom, explosion of vision.
Actually, most of the volunteers described it as being blown out of a nuclear cannon.
Whoa.
It was so fast and so intense, it was really quite startling. I infused the drug over the space of around 30 seconds or so, and people felt the effects within a couple of heartbeats of the beginning of the injection. And within about a minute after the completion of the infusion of the DMT, they were, you know, completely unaware of the room that they were in. They were out of their bodies. They were in some hyper-dimensional, very unusual, colorful kind of psychedelic realm that completely captivated, blew away any other element in their mental content for maybe 3, 5, 10 minutes or so. And then they started coming down at 15 to 20 minutes and were able to start describing their experiences soon thereafter and felt pretty normal, other than being somewhat slack-jawed from, you know, as a result of the experience. Within a half hour, even 45 minutes or so, they were able to eat and drink tea and answer questionnaires and carry on a normal conversation.
And did you find some sort of a common thread in their experiences and in their hallucinations? For example, you were talking about the plant element in ayahuasca. Was this a common element in the DMT studies as well?
Well, the plant consciousness wasn't all that common with our IV DMT studies. You know, well, the effects began within a few heartbeats. They peaked within a minute or two. And I suppose in terms of commonalities, the most common things people described were being completely out of body. They felt as if the energy that was coursing through their bodies just couldn't be contained in their bodies, you know, beyond a certain point, and their consciousness, you know, kind of burst out of the confines of their, you know, physical existence. So then they found themselves in a very colorful, you know, visionary sort of realm. You know, I was expecting people to be going under, you know, to be undergoing mystical experiences, cosmic consciousness, near-death experiences, those kinds of things. But I'm actually, you know, one of the most common features of the experience in a lot of our volunteers was the encounter with these entities, with these beings, with these intelligent, you know, sentient, I wouldn't call them actually, you know, life forms, but for lack of another, you know, term to kind of capture the essence, you know, they were living and they were interacting with the volunteers. And, you know, that was the most startling aspect, I think, of the stories that I heard from our volunteers.
How did they describe these beings? They were spirit beings, or were they entities, or did you have any more information for us on that?
Oh, you know, they look like insects sometimes, like reptiles sometimes, like humanoids other times, machinery, furniture,
wow.
Plants. I would say plants are that common. You know, insects, bees, praying mantises, alligators.
That's interesting because, of course, a lot of this is ET symbology. And I'd love to know if you do any conclusions for some of these visions.
Well, I was certainly struck, and the volunteers were also struck by some of the similarities in the description of their experiences with the stories that people tell that have undergone the experience of abduction. You know, with aliens or entities or ETs, those kinds of things. You know, our studies took place in the early 1990s, and to be honest, I was not that familiar with the abduction literature at all, and, you know, the rest of our volunteers weren't that interested or exposed to those kinds of ideas or stories either. You know, so it was only after the studies were completed, you know, in 1995 or so, that I actually started reading some of the abduction literature, like John Mack's book and Whitley Strieber's work, those kinds of things, to, you know, determine if indeed there were any comparisons or overlap or any kind of similarities between what my volunteers were reporting and what those people in the abduction literature were reporting. Yeah, and actually,
no doubt, you found quite a lot of astonishing similarities.
Well, astonishing similarities, even with the onset. You know, one of the common experiences in people that are being abducted is this loud crackling, kind of crinkling sound, and a buildup of inner tension and pressure, and a bursting out of their consciousness from their bodies. You know, it was almost verbatim compared to the descriptions of the DMT volunteers. Yeah, you know, so I did start speculating, you know, thereafter that perhaps there is a type of abduction experience, perhaps consciousness to consciousness, which may occur through spontaneous increases in naturally occurring DMT.
Would you be suggesting then that even in the potential, this is pure speculation, the potential that this DMT would potentially exist even in alien species? Is this what you're saying?
Well, I don't think necessarily, although that's an interesting idea. You know, Whitley Strieber interviewed me early on after my book came out, and, you know, one of his comments, you know, was that there weren't any stigmata in our DMT volunteers. Especially commonly described the grays, you know, the little creatures with the big eyes and the bald heads. With the gray skin. You know, but I was, you know, after that interview or even, you know, during it, I was thinking, you know, that there could be a spectrum of ET contacts, you know, from the purely physical to physical ones, you know, which I don't know that much about. I can't really comment on. On the other hand, though, there could be pure consciousness to consciousness encounters, you know, that don't depend on any kind of, you know, physical correspondence or, you know, physical effects per se.
Well, this is a very interesting conversation because it's the first time I've thought about or come across the idea that there may be some sort of chemical transcendent vehicle here that would be linking people dimensionally, multidimensionally. And if you're saying that this chemical exists in many different kinds of mammals and plants, it's definitely potential that it could exist in an alien species or more.
It could. Well, yeah, there's got to be some, you know, medium of communication through which the different, you know, entities communicate. You know, either us or the DMT species or entities, or between us and plants or animals that contain DMT.
Wow. It's really very exciting. Let me just interrupt a moment so that I can let people know, that people that are coming in late, that I've got with me Dr. Rick Strassman, and we're talking about not one but two of his books. The one we're talking about now is DMT, the Spirit Molecule, which has been out a while. Some really fascinating information coming out. And Dr. Rick's website is www.rickstrassman.com. So you'll want to jot that down, and after this interview, you'll take a look at his site and see what he's up to, which is a lot. All right. Sorry, Dr. Rick. I just wanted to make sure people know who's talking and who they can connect with here. All right. So we've got this great idea going here that there is at least a potential that in alien species we may possibly have some sort of chemical. I keep searching for a word. It's not a connector. It's not a vehicle, but some sort of similar.
It could be a transducer, maybe. How does that sound?
Transducer works for me.
Yeah. I think
fantastic idea.
Yeah.
So what do we do with your information that you've gathered in your boy? I wouldn't have minded being one of those in your study, let me tell you.
It was pretty grueling. People got hooked up to a couple IVs and a temperature monitor in their rectum and a blood pressure cuff, and it was in a hospital bed in a hospital.
No, that doesn't sound like fun.
No, it was no fun. I discouraged people from volunteering, actually. It was a fairly hardcore group of volunteers that participated. Yeah, you know, but despite that, I didn't really coach people all that much for what to expect, because I just wanted them to have their own trips. You know, but one of the things I did tell people is they might be afraid that they've died, you know, because the onset is so fast and so intense and so totally mind-blowing And as a matter of fact, most of the volunteers were ultimately glad to have been in the hospital because, you know, the thought did cross most of their minds that they were dead and, you know, they were in an after-death state.
But
and
do you think you might have set that up by telling them to by bringing it up in the first place?
No, I don't really think so. No, you know, I was just kind of warning them as opposed to telling them it was going to happen. No, I don't really think so because, you know, yeah, it was beyond suggestion what people were undergoing. Yeah, and actually, you know, they were able to kind of think with a glimmering of their self-consciousness that retained, you know, that, oh, I am in the hospital. I may have been overdosed and I'm dying, but at least I'm in a hospital and there's a recovery team around if need be to help resuscitate me. You know, so...
Well, no, okay, take it back. I definitely wouldn't want to have been one of these people, and I admire people for committing themselves to doing this for the sake of helping you, helping us understand the workings of the human mind. But good God, that sounds pretty intense.
It was intense. Yeah, you know, thankfully, you know, everybody went through safe and in flying colors. But you know, there were some tight squeezes there here, you know, every so often.
So how does this work into a discussion of the activating of the pineal gland? How does this DMT question relate to the workings of the misunderstood pineal gland?
Yeah. Well, the whole pineal thing has really kind of been a kind of a bugaboo for me in a lot of ways. You know, I began my research career studying the function of the pineal hormone melatonin in humans because I, you know, was impressed with the stories in the esoteric literature of a spiritual function of the pineal gland. And I was thinking, gee, wouldn't it be cool if the pineal was the place where certain chemical reactions took place that elevated consciousness to a high spiritual plane? And, you know, I obviously, within a clinical psychiatry research sort of model, couldn't make those kinds of hypotheses up front in the research design. So I began studying the effects of melatonin to perhaps determine if it were, you know, psychoactive in any kind of a psychedelic manner. This was 1984 or so, and there wasn't all that much known about melatonin. So we gave a lot of people lots of melatonin, but not much happened really. It was quite sedating, which has ultimately, you know, turned out to be the main, you know, psychological response to melatonin, as it helps you sleep. You know, because the melatonin studies weren't that encouraging from the psychedelic point of view, I changed the course of my research direction and went into the DMT work. And I speculated in the book about a possible pineal source of DMT, but that, you know, is speculation. You know, we just don't really know if DMT is made in the pineal or not. It would be pretty
So where is DMT produced in the body?
You know, well, the main place is in the lungs, which is very interesting, too, because of, you know, the relationship between lung and spirit and breath and breathing exercises and all of those kinds of relationships that exist.
So you're suggesting that process of, well, even breathing in and out in the slow breath patterns for meditation do induce that state of preparation for altered consciousness.
Well, sure, and, you know, Stan Grof's holotropic breath work, you know, kind of exploits the breath by, you know, prolonged extensive hyperventilation, you know, which cause extremely psychedelic states without, you know, the ingestion of any outside administered drug.
Have you ever taken
I'm sorry?
Have you ever injected yourself with the DMT?
Oh, no, I couldn't be, you know, subject in my own study. You know, Tim Leary kind of ruined that, you know, for all of the medical, you know, for all of the American researchers out there.
Yeah, I was going to bring him up, but I didn't know how he fit into the timeline.
It is interesting because there are other studies going on in Europe of giving psychedelic drugs, and it's required of the investigators to go first. You know, both, you know, for purposes of being able to really give informed consent to prospective volunteers, And also in terms of going first, you know, is this a reasonable thing to be doing to humans? And, you know, it, you know, seems ethical, you know, for the researcher to go first in that case of a highly experimental procedure.
Now, what kind of experiments are going on in Europe that, may I ask, that relate to your work with the DMT molecule?
Yeah, well, almost 20 years ago, there was a German group that, you know, kind of started this, you know, all these sorts of studies again in, you know, the whole world, actually. They began by giving people mescaline. You know, that's the active ingredient in the peyote cactus. You know, subsequently, they studied psilocybin in both Germany and Switzerland, MDMA, you know, ketamine. There was one DMT study that took place in Germany around 2004 or so, you know, kind of based on our model. And also there's ayahuasca work that's been going on at the University of Barcelona for quite some time now. That's still going on.
Yeah, you know, I'm curious about this because my own interest in this phenomenon is that if you were going to the spiritual nature of it, so that if you were going to take an ayahuasca journey, you would want to take it with the shamans, go through the process they go through, worshiping the plant, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm just wondering about the clinical use of these substances in, like, say, let's say laboratory conditions, and how this environment affects the human mind.
Yeah, well, you know, it had been a really long time in the U.S., you know, since any studies had taken place with these drugs of any sort, you know, LSD, psilocybin, mescaline, DMT. And ultimately, I was interested in, you know, the beneficial properties of these drugs, either from a therapeutic point of view or a spiritual point of view. But in a lot of ways, my study kind of had to reinvent the wheel. In order to establish that we could give these drugs to human beings in a safe manner, and we could, generate, you know, some reasonable scientific data.
This is not the case.
But yeah, in the first stage of things, you just kind of had to establish that you could give the drugs, you know, in a safe manner, and you could generate some data. You know, so I was kind of both constrained and, you know, liberated at the same time by kind of using a pharmacology model as opposed to a, you know, psychotherapeutic or a spiritual model. You know, subsequently there have been some psychotherapeutic studies of these drugs in the States, you know, there's more going on too. You know, but we just kind of had to open up the door that had been locked for so long.
And so from there you, I don't know how long it took you to write your latest book, Inner Paths to Outer Space, but I'd like to shift to that now and ask you, first of all, what was the time spent from that first book to your going ahead with this new book, which, by the way, I haven't read yet?
Yeah, well, you know, it's a co-authored book. There's three other authors besides myself, and actually the book itself wasn't my idea. It was the brainchild of the second author, who is a oncology researcher, actually, who works for a big drug company. You know, and he's also very interested in the whole realm of science fiction. He's written a science fiction book or two, and he's a science fiction illustrator.
Talk about a varied spectrum of interests and skills.
Said
he was a doctor of oncology, right?
Right, yeah. Well, he's an oncology researcher, actually, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah. And he's also quite interested in the whole, you know, realm of science fiction. Yeah, and mm-hmm. So after he read my DMT book, he was thinking it would be very interesting, you know, to educate, you know, the community of people interested in you know, science fiction about the overlap in the material in the DMT book with the material that people are always reading and writing about within the science fiction community. It was his idea, you know, to write the book as a collaborative effort. So then I contacted an anthropologist who's got quite a bit of experience with ayahuasca, named Dr. Luna, Eduardo Luna. Then he contacted a friend of his named Edie Frexa, who's a Hungarian psychiatrist who's done quite a bit of research in kind of the quantum mechanical aspects of, you know, the higher stages of consciousness. So the four of us kind of embarked on a multi-authored book. So I just kind of, you know, summarized the DMT work in the first three chapters I contribute. You know, the only original contribution I think I make, to the book is the last, chapter, in which case I, you know, kind of lay out the groundwork for a psychedelic experience, the kind of preparation that is, you know, necessary to go through, the issues regarding set and, you know, setting, to optimize the effects and to minimize the, any possible bad reactions. The other authors contribute chapters on ayahuasca, on, you know, esoteric, you know, psychiatry, you know, some of the more popular, some of the more popular aspects of, you know, psychedelic drug use in contemporary culture, those kinds of things. But throughout, we're, you know, kind of gearing it, towards the question of, you know, contact with spiritual levels of reality, and especially the possibility that those spiritual levels of reality could be inhabited by entities that, you know, are conscious of us and we can be conscious of them.
So that the essence of the book is helping people, let me understand this, helping people understand the process and helping them to prepare for such a process? Were they to embark on one?
Well, that's my last, you know, chapter in the book. You know, the rest of the book, though, you know, kind of, it's called Inner Paths to Outer Space. You know, so in other words, instead of looking outward for, knowledge and information about alternative levels of reality, we're kind of encouraging people to think about it as a phenomena that can be contacted through our consciousness as opposed to through building spaceships and telescopes and those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's kind of an updated version in a way of a shamanic model, I suppose, of, looking at alternative levels of reality.
Can you tell us a little bit about why it's such a violent process? I mean, I hear that these people basically spend, I don't know how many hours, with just kind of really going through terrible physical suffering. I don't understand how wonderful it could be if you spend so much time sick in the bathroom. So what is going on physically or chemically that people get so sick?
Oh, with ayahuasca? Are you speaking about ayahuasca?
Yeah.
Oh, well, I wouldn't really call myself an expert on ayahuasca, but, you know, from what I've heard anyway, it's a purgative. It makes people vomit, makes people have diarrhea. But the stories I've heard is, you know, the more you've taken it and the more familiar you become with its effects, and you learn, and also as time goes on, you incorporate, you know, some of the lessons that you might have learned under the influence, you know, which could be as simple and straightforward as, you know, changing your diet, you know, stopping drinking alcohol or smoking cigarettes or those kinds of things. If you can kind of simplify and purify your life, apparently, you know, the unpleasant responses to ayahuasca start diminishing over time, and you don't spend much time in the bathroom at all, actually. You know, but it can be a harsh sort of ride. Well, you know, it's a great healer, ayahuasca, you know, from everything I've heard. And one of the stages of healing is to throw off your illness, to kind of get rid of what's eating you inside. That could be pretty unpleasant sometimes.
Yeah, I've heard a lot of people describe this as the dark night of their soul, and having to, going through that and having this amazing, liberating experience. And the snakes, people keep reporting encountering the two snakes. It's sort of like a gateway into the spirit world.
The whole snake motif is obviously really interesting. You know, I've read a description of the the skin of the snake, of the visions, you know, it's the skin of the snake, that the visions play out on. I really wouldn't call myself an expert in the field. You know, but it is DMT-like, it seems. You know, it's extremely visual. It's extremely, novel. It's quite emotional. Insights to personal, psychological, creative problems can emerge. But I think, the unique combination of the two plants themselves seem to combine in a way that's optimally, healing for the person. From the descriptions I've heard, there's this extraordinary intelligence that's both incredibly powerful, but at the same time incredibly wise and kind. So the combination can, at first anyway, really, put one through the ringer.
Well, again, what interests me here, and I think it's emerging from our conversation tonight, is the potential that it is the DMT that is the, what was the word you used, transducer?
The transducer. It's the visionary component at the very least.
But not from the point of view of the altered state of consciousness of the human being, that it fascinates me as much as the idea that potentially the DMT chemical connection between different layers of consciousness, different layers or species of conscious beings is quite fascinating.
Well, yeah, it's a what's the word? It's a good idea. and it can lead to speculation. It can lead to experiments too.
Yeah. Well, geez. Sounds amazing. So what do you feel is it, what do you tell, when people ask you what this book is about, what is the essence of this book? Why was this book written?
The DMT book or the Inner Paths book?
The Inner Paths book.
Well, it was kind of a, follow-up. Some of the questions that the first DMT book raised about cross-species communication, about communication between alien life forms, what's going on with the ayahuasca ceremonies and the ayahuasca state. It was a chance for a number of us to get together and compare notes about what some of the implications of the DMT state and my DMT studies seem to be. There isn't original research in the Inner Paths book. It's, more of a follow-up and a compilation. Isn't this interesting, and what kind of things can we draw to, to help us, kind of focus on what's going on in the DMT realm?
Yeah, I was going to say it's interesting that I'm an old 60s, early 70s girl, San Francisco girl. So I remember this... this time of experiment with hallucinogenics, and there was a lot of recreational drug use going on, but there was also a lot of using hallucinogenics for deep spiritual pursuits. And it seems like that disappeared, and an era of recreational drugs came in. And here now again, we seem to be seeing people looking maybe for a fast track to that spiritual explosive experience, but nonetheless, so many people starting to go to this, let's say, shamanic use of what they call spirit medicine, and this is very exciting in a sense of defining the moment and people's relationships with the experience. Am I making any sense here? I seem to be very wordy.
Yeah. No, I completely agree with you. Well, one of the interesting, things is I get quite a bit of email every day from people that have read the books. And, the vast majority of the emails I get are from kids between the ages of 18 and 25. They're very interested in this work. And they're very interested in using these drugs for spiritual purposes as opposed to purely as opposed to purely recreational, like you were talking about. So I'm really encouraged that this, you know, generation of young adults has really got it, you know, fairly well figured out about, you know, what's the best, you know, in terms of what the best, you know, ways to use these, you know, substances might be. You know, they've learned from our mistakes and they've kind of bypassed the purely hedonistic perspective of...
Now that's really good to hear. Not that I, you know, for a minute I'm espousing that kids should get out and use any kind of drugs, but I mean, it's good to hear that you're getting inquiries as to the, that, like you've said, that the drug as a vehicle to spiritual awakening and not just blasting themselves out of the planet for the night, because...
Well, yeah. You know, I just got a couple of emails already today from kids, you know, that are in school and they want to do what I did. And, you know, and they want to know how to do it and what kind of schooling to get and what kind of training to undergo. Yeah, you know, so, you know, I just got two emails like that. You know, so it's a time of great, you know, ferment, I think, for young adults.
Plus, no question that the shamans are back in it, rediscovering a lot of their power that has been dormant for so many years. A lot of people are doing this journeying with shamans in Brazil and Peru and Mexico.
Well, yeah, and, you know, so that's a good thing. Maybe it's not such a good thing. You know, there isn't quite the quality control in shamanism as, you know, there is within the medical profession.
Yeah.
So I think that one has to be extraordinarily careful, you know, who you go down to study with in Peru or Brazil or Venezuela.
Right, but then on the other hand, there aren't people that can go to a doctor and say, I'd like to have, you know, an ayahuasca experience. It's still kind of...
Yeah, I know.
...cold in the environment that's being used outside of the shaman trail.
Right, I know. And, you know, that's our fault.
Because ayahuasca is still illegal, right?
Yeah. Well, you can only use it in the States if you belong to one of these churches from Brazil. And, you know, there actually is a branch in Santa Fe. That's the headquarters in the U.S. But otherwise, yeah, if you're not participating in one of the ceremonies of this particular church, then it is illegal.
Now, why is that being allowed? Because it's considered medicine for the spiritual practice of the church?
Yeah, they kind of, you know, made the analogy between its use in this church with the use of peyote in the Native American church.
And peyote is not illegal if you're using it with Native Americans?
Exactly.
Well, geez, that's news to me.
Yeah. It's, you know, called the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. You know, Indians can use peyote, and if you're a white person, you can use peyote in a, you know, Native American church ceremony. Within quite a few states in the U.S. I think there are some states you can't, but, you know, in quite a few states you can. And, you know, with this UDV church, you know, that uses ayahuasca from Brazil, you know, they've got Supreme Court permission to go ahead and use it, but only within the context of one of their ceremonial events.
So needless to say, there are a lot of ceremonial events going on in the States.
Well, it's every other Saturday with the church in Santa Fe and once a month for some special ceremony. So, yeah, it's about three times a month for them.
But so what are they doing? They're cooking up ayahuasca, which I thought was made from the bark of a tree, and then just using it in an environment like a church environment, not out in nature? How's this
exactly.
work?
Exactly. Yeah, it's indoors, under lights, in chairs with music playing and people giving testimonies and question and answers. And,
how
you know,
can people find out about that? Is that something you can tell us?
Well, the church that's got permission is called the UDV, and you can just enter it into Google. Also, there's another church that got state permission so far, that's in Oregon. They're called the Santo Daime. So they got approval from the state Supreme Court in Oregon, but, you know, they haven't taken it to the U.S. Supreme Court yet, you know, which the UDV did.
Well, again, I'm not suggesting people go out there and do this, but the show is about finding out information about every kind of out-of-the-matrix subject. So you can find out more about this from Dr. Rick's information that he's given you. And believe it or not, we're getting toward the end of our time together, Dr. Rick. Is there any one predominant thought you'd like to leave with people about your work and... what you've extracted from this process?
Yeah, well, That's a good question. Yeah, well, you know, I would like to, you know, to reiterate that I'm not encouraging anybody to take DMT or use ayahuasca. It's pretty hairy. It's pretty scary. You really have to be together and have good supervision. You know, so I'm not encouraging anybody to either break the law or damage themselves, you know, psychologically.
No, not at all. I think what we are encouraging people to do is to explore their spirituality and to not be afraid to investigate information, but by no means is anyone here proposing that people jump off and do anything that's damaging or illegal. That's not what the show's about. But
right.
It is about providing information about everything beyond the matrix, as I just said. And this is certainly it. And your books are outside the matrix, even though they are founded in science and methodology. They propose wild ideas like plants communicating with us and potentially through a chemical. It's very exciting.
It is very interesting. Yeah. And, you know, you kind of wonder why God put, you know, DMT in all of us. So, you know, I've been thinking lots about that over the last 10 or 12 years as well.
Yeah, well, I'm sure a lot of us are going to be thinking about it a lot more now that we've had you on the show. Once again, my guest has been Dr. Rick Strassman. His website is www.rickstrassman.com. These books are not new. DMT, The Spirit Molecule, is really a very popular book. Please support him by investigating his site, and you're going to want to read these books. I'm going to be reading the new one. I haven't gotten to it yet, but I'm sure it'll be a great read. Dr. Rick, thank you so much for coming on the show, and keep up your wonderful work, and let us keep abreast of new ideas that are surfacing from your wonderful research and investigations with the spirit mind.
Okay, well, thanks very much for having me on today.
Thank you, too. Okay, everybody, that's a wind-up beyond the matrix for people who dare to think outside the box of convention. Stay with us next week. I haven't confirmed my guest yet, but I promise you more daring thoughts about subjects that are not mainstream. Goodbye, everybody. I'll be back with you on Thursday, full of energy. Looking forward to being back with you. This is Patricia Corey. Don't forget to check out my site, SyrianRevelations.net. Until next week, ciao, ciao.